Welcome to episode 240 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. Today is a sustainability special. We're going to be looking at train travel to Morzine and other nearby resorts, the impact of global warming on the Mer de Glace in Chamonix and the new gondola there. Plus, we're going to take a look at Patagonia's decision to become a company for purpose, not profit, and what that actually means. As well as that, we have our regular snow reports, the latest from GB Snow Sports, and your feedback. Now, my name's Ian Martin. I'd like to introduce my guest today. Firstly, I'm delighted to be joined for the first time since episode 74 by Sarah Burden from Montanvert in Morzine. Hi, Sarah. How are you?
Hi, Ian. Very good, thanks. And you?
I am good as well. We were chatting in the green room earlier. You told me you're not actually in Morzine at the moment, but you are in the Alps. Where are you just now?
So I'm just across the border into Italy in the Aosta Valley. So very close to Morzine, but just the other side of Mont Blanc.
Okay, excellent. Well, we'll come back to that shortly in a minute. My second guest joins me for the first time on the show. He's also a podcaster who's published even more episodes than me. I'm delighted to welcome Matt Barr from the Looking Sideways podcast. Hi, Matt. How are you?
All right, Ian. How you doing? You all right?
I'm very well. I think you're also in Brighton as I am. Is that right?
I am in Brighton. Well, Port Slade, actually. Yeah, in my shed. I am off to France April the 1st for 6 months, visas notwithstanding, because I got a place in Normandy, so we're going to head over there for the rest of the year, well, for most of the rest of the year. But yeah, really looking forward to that. You know, it's been a good winter, but a long winter, so be good to get over there for sure.
Cool. Okay. Well, a question I always like to ask my guests on the show is, when did you ski or snowboard last? Let's start with you, Sarah. You're in the mountains. I'm guessing it's fairly recently.
Yeah, I guess I'm pretty lucky in that I get to ski every weekend. So it was last weekend for me, Saturday and Sunday. Spent the night actually in a winter room, so a refuge, but one that is unmanned. So you take up all your own food and cook for yourselves up there on the Grand Paradiso area in the Aosta Valley. So I was out ski touring Saturday and Sunday. Pretty amazing conditions. There was quite a bit of snow last week.
Oh, I've done that before, an unmanned refuge, and it was tremendous fun when I did. I was there by myself. There was like a pile of wood and an axe, and you basically had to chop up your own wood and get the fire going, and that was all that there was in there to keep you warm. Was it similar to that?
Yep, it was exactly that. So you start heating yourself up by chopping the wood, get the stove going, and then it ended up being fairly cozy as I was just up there with my husband, but there were two other groups up there, and there was 10 of us in total in a little room with 9 beds and about a seating space for 4 people. So we got it warm fairly quickly.
Okay, right, that's slightly different. I was the only one up there when I tried it. And I couldn't get the gas to work on the hob as well, which is meant to be available. Were you able to cook yourself a warm meal, a hot meal in the evening?
Well, the one we were in, we knew there wasn't going to be any gas or any cooking facilities. So we took our little camping stove up with us. So, yes, we had a bowl of pasta and then some porridge in the morning and coffee.
What I really like about that sort of thing is like the getting up in the morning and you're on the mountain, there's no one around. I assume it was out of the lift system, that type of area, yeah?
Exactly, yeah. We were somewhere where there were no lifts. And in the morning as well, all of us headed off in different directions and we didn't see, I think, anyone else until we got back down to civilization late afternoon.
That's beautiful. What about yourself, Matt? When were you last on snow?
I was last on snow. I haven't ridden a lot this year. I have just been surfing in Sri Lanka for 2 weeks, which is a lot of fun. But I was snowboarding last, actually staying with our mutual friend Chris Moran. Yeah, it was a lot of fun, actually, because I'd spent a lot of time in Maribel and the Three Valleys when I was younger and had a really nice powder day where I kind of got to revisit a lot of those old, like, season air runs that I used to do when I was a kid. Quite, and, like, strangely quiet. Which I think it was like, because it was Christmas week. I don't know. There weren't many people. You know, normally those runs are the first things to get tracked, aren't they? And I kept looking at all these runs and thinking, like, why is no one riding that? So I went and did them, and it was fun.
And just to clarify, that is over in the Three Valleys, because his place is over in Courchevel, Bordeaux. And you used to be based in Maribel area. You were doing seasons.
Well, we did, like, a big group of us did I think maybe 5 seasons in Maribel, but it's a long time ago. It's like 25 years ago. And I've been going back ever since, but it was just one. It's the first time I've had good snow there for a long time. So it was fun. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to try and get a trip in before I head to Normandy, I think.
And when I go back to places where I've done seasons, I often find myself looking at the mountain and looking at different kind of runs or pitches that I've skied down and thinking, what the hell was I thinking? Why did I do that?
I often just think back to how stupid we all were with our lack of safety and avalanche awareness, really. We're so fortunate, I think, that there weren't more accidents, really. And like, it's a memory lane thing, isn't it? When you go back to ski resorts, you do go like, oh yeah, god, I remember that. So yeah, I mean, it's really nice to revisit those areas at a bit of an older age, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I will be out skiing again next week. I'm going to Selva Val Gardena in the Dolomites, having never been to the Dolomites at all until January. I'm now going there twice in 3 months, so looking forward to that trip. But we do have some snow reports, some of our regular snow reports to have a listen to. We've got Catherine Murphy out in Austria, Bethany in France, and Floss Cockle reporting from Teen. So let's have a listen to those.
Hiya Ian, it's Catherine Murphy here in Caprun in Austria's Salzburgerland. Today I've been skiing on the Kitzsteinhorn Glacier up to an altitude of 3,029 metres. It's been a busy bluebird day on the glacier today. Busy for two reasons. First of all, it's carnival, so local people have a day off to enjoy the slopes, but also because some lower skiers are struggling snow-wise, which is bringing skiers up to the glacier in search of better snow. Early this morning, temperatures on the glacier were between 0 and minus 4 degrees. By the time I skied down to Caprun at around 3:30 today, it was 11 or 12 degrees, so it has been a warm, sunny day, and more of the same forecast for the rest of this week. Sun, sun, sun all the way. No snow on the horizon, unfortunately, at the moment. But having said that, the snow is holding up really well on the glacier. There were maybe pockets of shaved, polished snow on black runs like Black Mamba, but in general, the conditions are really good. The majority of people are staying on piste. I think the conditions off piste could best be described as variable. I did try a little bit of side country and I thought, oh, this is lovely. Some of it was lovely and soft, and then some of it was a bit more variable. It was also possible today to ski all the way back down to Caprun, which is great at this time of year. I took the 3G connector cable car, which links the glacier at Kitzsteinhorn with Caprun. That dropped me at Maiskogel for one last long run back down to Caprun. The only thing I will say about that long run down to Caprun is that it was slushy, bumpy, all the way. I was hanging on for dear life. So that's it. A forecast of lots of sun for the rest of this week in Caprun. Cheers.
Hi Ian, it's Bethany phoning in a snow report from Combloux, which is in the Mont Blanc Valley, sharing its skiing with Megève and not too far from Saint-Gervais at all. So what can I tell you? I'm looking at the slopes now. We're definitely in spring-like conditions, a bit of green, bit of white. We've got a tale of two stories really, and that's between the morning and the afternoon. So kind of hard pack in the morning, very cut up and a bit slushy in the afternoons. Tale of two stories in terms of the north and south facing slopes. So the north facing slopes are skiing well, south facing slopes are suffering a little bit. And also the higher you go, of course, the snow is a little bit better. So high altitude wise, actually the pistes are in great condition, and the pistes here have done a really good job of keeping them that way. So if you're coming out for your holiday, then this weekend the weather looks like it's going to change. We've got a little bit of precipitation in the forecast for next week, and hopefully high up that will fall as snow. But honestly, if you're coming out, expect some much quieter slopes. And yeah, you know, there's lots of skiing to be had all over the Alps, so you'll have a great time. Thanks, Ian. Till next time. Bye.
Hi, this is Floss from Free Flow Ski, bringing you the weather report from Teen and Val d'Isère. Now, I can't tell you how much this week has been amazing. It's been back-to-back sunshine and with gentle winds for once. We've had a true experience of the spring conditions, and I've been absolutely loving it. Above 2,000 metres in the morning, the pistes have been heroic and a corduroy, and then you have the softer conditions in the afternoon. Now, deep, fresh snow can be found in the backcountry in ski touring routes. The off-piste routes, especially north-facing, are skied out. However, they are still soft, And if you know where you're going, you can still find pockets of fresh powder. This week has been the last week of the French holidays, and with just Zone C off, we are now looking forward to quieter slopes and the mountain back next week. After the weekend, winter is back with colder temperatures and snow is arriving and forecasted in the middle of the week. So I just wanted to wish you all happy sliding from Free Flow Floss.
Don't forget, if you want to help the Ski Podcast and save yourself some money this winter, all you need to do is use the code SKIPODCAST when you book your ski hire at InSportRent.com. Thanks to everybody who's used that code already this season. Quite simply, it helps fund the podcast and I appreciate it. So simply use the code SKIPODCAST or simply take the link in the show notes and your discount will automatically be applied. Now, I've got a bit of Team GB news. There was another win for Charlotte Banks in the snowboard cross at the weekend. She's got four wins now. She is highly likely to win the Crystal Globe. And by my calculations, that would mean she would join Mia Brooks, who's already won the Crystal Globe for Big Air, Zoe Atkin, Halfpipe. And it looks like it could be another win for Jasmine Taylor in the Telemark Sprint. And that would be four British Crystal Globe winners, which would be unprecedented. Actually, check with GB Snowsport. And apparently Mia has a good shot at the slopestyle title as well. And the overall globe. So it could be six Crystal Globes in total, which, you know, a year ahead of the Winter Olympics is very exciting news. Now, I'm going to turn to you, Sarah, if I can. I know you mentioned you're living in Italy at the moment, but the reason I wanted to have you on the show and the reason you were on the show last time round, we were talking about Morzine, but specifically you've changed your role since you were last on the show. You used to be working for the tourist office and now you're working for an organisation called Montagne Verte, who we have covered on the show before, but for the benefit of listeners who haven't heard those previous episodes, I wonder if you could just give us a bit of insight as to what Montagne Verte is.
Yeah, exactly. So Montagne Verte is an association in France, which is a not-for-profit. We started in early 2019. And although it's fairly recent that I've actually been working for Montagne Verte, I've been a member and a volunteer since the very start. It all started with one local woman who got together a group of friends with the idea of engaging Morzine to reduce plastic waste and plastic consumption. Pretty quickly, it became clear we needed to go wider than that. So as well as organising community events, developing a website, it was decided that we should go beyond just Morzine and beyond just plastic. So the mission became to approach sustainability as a whole and a valley-wide operation. So we were officially registered as a not-for-profit public benefit association in August 2019 and then widened from Morzine to Haute-Chablais. Haute-Chablais is probably less well-known, but it's the area that includes Morzine, Avoria, Léger, Montrion, and then even further afield down towards Geneva Lake. So we're basically funded by the community we serve, and our mission is to develop solutions for our region to reduce its environmental impact.
Do you want to give us an indication of some of the initiatives that you've started and some of the initiatives that Montagne Verte run in the area?
Yes, so we started with or more on the education side, which was a lot of events. We're very community focused, so we still do lots of events, particularly in the interseason time for the community. We'll be starting up things like sewing groups from this springtime, and lots of speakers, films, that kind of thing we put on. Our first really big other project was our secondhand shop. So we were inspired, Matt mentioned Bozelle earlier, we were inspired by One Tree, who are based in Bozelle, to start up a secondhand shop, but also de-logoing ski wear. So there isn't the same culture in France that there is in the UK of the charity shops that you find on every high street. They're a lot rarer over here. And we see a huge amount of textile waste, particularly with ski clothing. And so what we can do is take things like jackets from ski instructors. They need them, obviously, to be performing incredibly well as they're out there all day, every day, in every weather. We can take their ones as they replace them, cover the logos, and then that becomes really affordable ski wear and stops those going into landfill, incineration, not being used. So that was the first big project we did, which you could say around the circular economy.
That shop is in Morzine, is it?
Yep, so we're right in the centre of Morzine.
Someone's out there on holiday, for example, you know, most of my kids and their friends buy all of their clothes on Vinted or different pre-loved apps, etc. You can go into that store and buy used ski wear, which is, you said it's been de-logoed, so it might have been owned by a ski school before and you've replaced those logos or taken them off somehow?
Yeah, so what we do, so some of it might just be a jacket from the likes of you or I because we no longer like the colour, because there's a lot of wealthy people that come skiing and like to replace their jacket maybe after a couple of years. You want your Instagram photos to not always be the same. And then others might come from, say, a ski school or a chalet company or hotel. And what we'll do is cover that logo with a patch from another jacket. So, for example, we recently had a fairly large donation from one tour operator, and we were able to use some of the jackets where, say, a zip was broken or they were stained or ripped, to use that material to patch up the others. And that means that for, say, anything from 40 to 70 euros, you can get an incredibly good quality ski jacket rather than having to pay many hundreds for a brand new one. And it keeps these in use.
Oh, well, I mean, that sounds really good. I possibly dispute the idea that people want him to buy a new jacket every year just so they can get a new Instagram shot, but maybe there are people out there like that. But certainly there's a big body of people who are interested in buying pre-loved clothing. I mean, Hooski is a website, not sure if you're familiar with. We promoted them on the site before, and I've sold a bunch of stuff through them. But that sounds great. So that's one of the things that you're doing. There's also work in relation to bringing together a lot of the accommodation providers in terms of food waste.
Yes, exactly. So that was another one, you could say, in the same kind of area of reducing waste. Food waste generally goes to be incinerated, which is energy intensive, or it's buried, which creates methane, which is actually has a greater warming potential than carbon dioxide. However, it can be composted or methanized. What we do is we go around to hotels, restaurants, chalet companies that work with us to collect their kitchen waste by bike. We've got an e-bike with a big electric trailer behind it with bins on it. We'll collect their waste from them, collect it into a central point, and then once a week it's picked up to go down and be methanized, turned into biogas.
Regular listeners might remember I spoke to Josh from Verbier Green. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And he does a similar service over in Verbier, also because of the way that rubbish collections are so complicated in Switzerland. He fulfills a service there as well. In relation to the shop, do you offer like a repair service there as well?
It's not something we actually currently do. There are a couple of seamstresses in Morzine who do offer that kind of service, so we'll tend to refer people onto them. What we've actually done on that side is we did do some sewing workshops last year where we taught people how to repair themselves. And we are looking at setting up a kind of group to help enable people to do this, so we can have sewing machines available for people to use. But we haven't currently got the capacity to actually do that.
Yeah. No problem at all. It just occurred to me, again, listeners who've listened to previous episodes will remember when I spoke to Arcteryx about their Rebird program and a lot of the repair options that are increasingly available there. Matt?
What's the reaction from the local community to this, Sarah?
It's actually generally been very positive. So we were nervous at first, particularly with the shops, and there was obviously some fear, would we be taking away business from them? But generally, the local population has been really positive. Montanvert's always gone for a collaborative approach. We're not a kind of radical opposition group. We're working with the local businesses because without them, I don't think we'd achieve nearly as much.
I think possibly the local business, etc., can see the upside from Montanvert, because it's not just this side of things. I mean, a really big initiative that you've introduced, which I wanted to ask you about, is the Alpine Express Pass. I think as many people as possible should really hear about this. Wondered if you could tell us what that is and what it gives visitors.
Yeah, so we started Alpine Express back in early 2022 with the idea simple reason that the biggest impact of anybody's holiday out to the mountains is their travel to get here. So we can hear a lot about skiing, the effect of that. But actually the skiing part of a stay is a tiny part of the overall emissions of any one stay. The biggest impact you can do is to get the train rather than the plane or even a private car. So we started that as a pass with discounts on accommodation, food, ski hire, and now as well your ski pass. So exactly as I said before, that would be impossible to do without local businesses participating. We're now up to 72 different ones. And what's really been, I think, the game changer for the pass was our three local lift companies coming on board. So there's a 10% discount on either the Port du Soleil or the Morzine Léger ski pass. So the idea of that is very much getting the train. It's often a more costly option than flying, sadly, but that can help if you can get 5-10% off your accommodation, off your pass, off some restaurants, your ski hire. That can help compensate that extra cost.
Sure. I think, you know, 10% off the lift pass is a significant amount. And I think a lot of people would make that decision to travel by train anyway. But I think it disappoints me that there aren't more resorts who are offering a discount to travel by train, because evidently, without going into the full conversation, you know, skiing and snowboarding is threatened existentially by global warming, and you can reduce your emissions significantly by traveling by train. And there are a few resorts that have kind of gone around the subject. You know, La Rosière do offer a discount, but I only found out recently that the discount is you get a voucher which you can use next season. You can't even use it that season to buy your lift pass. And to me, that's not even a real discount. You know, there should be more resorts. Via Lattia, the Milky Way in Italy, they give good discounts for traveling by train. But, you know, if you're a resort out there listening, I think you should be trying to keep up with Morzine and introducing these as well. And in relation to train travel, another reason I wanted to have you on is you recently, Montanvert recently published a new train travel guide. And I had a look at it. And, you know, I've done a lot of train travel. Listeners to the podcast will know that, you know, I'm normally traveling by train when I go out to the Alps. This is very, very detailed guide. You know, so impressive. It covers how you get to lots of different resorts. It's got station guides in there, how you deal with transfers, if you need to do that, stations along the way. It must have taken a very long time. Did you do it yourself?
Yeah, so I did do quite a bit of the work on it, but a lot of other people did as well. It's not a project that I think would be easy for one person to do alone. And again, the reason came, we started the Alpen Express Pass because of the cost implication of getting the train. But then what we were hearing back was how much more complicated it is. And it's true that where we're based, so for anyone coming to Morzine, Avoria, Léger, it's so easy to just fly to Geneva, jump on a transfer and get to resort. Actually, the train is a really easy way of getting out here. It just initially seems a lot more complicated. So what we looked at was what were the problems that people were facing. And it was knowing, am I going to find a toilet in the train station? Can I find food? And then in particular, it's the crossing Paris and then the getting from train station to resort. So we did the guidelines from everything to how you cross Paris, of which we used one of your great videos from one of your experiences getting between the Gare du Nord and Gare de Lyon. So thank you for that. Okay. And then particularly getting up to resort. So, for example, if you're coming to this area, you can get to Tonon or to Cluses. But if you get to Tonon, only 2 of the 7 or 9 buses a day can actually be booked in advance. And the other ones require cash. So knowing that in advance is a pretty useful thing for people to do, and to just not have that fear of the fact that they can't actually book the last part of the journey. There's always space on those buses, but a lot of people are worried, understandably, when they can't book that.
Unfortunately, or not, the final mile, as described, can often be not at all the most difficult, but it's can be a bit harder to find out information. I mean, if you travel by train, typically you can get way closer to the resort, and in most cases, or a lot of cases, into the resort itself, if you're going to like Chamonix or Zermatt or Andermatt or many others I could mention. But if you're traveling out to France like that, Tonon or Cluses, really good having that information in there. Thanks for using my video though. You know, of all the videos I've done, I sometimes spend a lot of time creating videos and no one watches them at all, but that video for how to cross Paris from Gare du Nord to Gare de Lyon has been watched about 15,000 times, so that one actually makes me quite happy to see that. I've got one more question for you about Montanvert and the train. I think, you know, over the years you've been working very closely with SNCF. We've sort of discussed the possibility before. It might have been with Al from Alicat Chalets about the possibility of a direct train from Lille to Cluses. Are we any closer to that at all? Might that happen?
So that was actually one of Montanvert's early, very first projects, was the idea that the train line exists from Lille to Cluses. That could serve a number of different resorts. And it actually makes it a lot easier as well, because you get the Eurostar to Lille. That can be the same from the UK, from Netherlands, from Belgium. And then you haven't got to cross Paris, which is obviously a bit more of an effort to do, particularly if you've got bags, skis, if you've got kids with you. We had plans initially to charter a train to put that on ourselves. However, then COVID came in, everything changed, and the conditions that were being put into place post-COVID made it impossible and far too much of a risk for us to do. So unfortunately, in terms of us taking that on, that is no longer a viable project for us. However, there is a huge amount of work that's being done by a lot of UK tour operators through the group SBIT, Seasonal Businesses and Travel, to lobby for this kind of train service to be put on. And we kind of think that anything we can do to support that work is great, but that's what's going to have the actual impact to do it. Those tour operators are going to have a lot more impact on SNCF than a small association like us.
Okay. Well, fingers crossed for that. I think, you know, we've regularly had people, Charlie Owen from SBIT on before, talking about that. And I know they're doing some train research at the moment. I think that's due to go live shortly. So we'll be finding more about that. But that's brilliant, Sarah. Thank you for sharing that and for letting listeners know a little bit more about Montanvert. And, you know, listener, if you want to save some money on your lift pass, go to Morzine and get the Alpine Express pass. If it's okay, I'm going to move on to Matt now. Regular listeners to the show will have heard Matt's name mentioned several times by guests on the show before, because he was in the vanguard of British snowboarding in the 90s. Ed Lee, Chris Moran, who you mentioned earlier, Stu Brass, among others, have mentioned him. I'll put a link in the show notes of those episodes. He's also a previous editor of White Lines. Now he runs his own agency, All Conditions Media. He works for brands like Adidas, Finisterre, Peak Performance and Rab. So Matt's story could be a podcast in itself, and probably should be one day. But I mentioned he hosts the Looking Sideways podcast. Matt, I wanted to have you on the show today to discuss a few episodes of the podcast that you released recently, and they were specifically about Patagonia. But before we come to that, I wondered if you could let listeners know a little bit more about the Looking Sideways podcast. You know, what prompted you to start it? Who do you interview?
Yeah, sure. I've been doing it 8 years now, which has gone pretty quick. So as you kind of mentioned, I've been a journalist working around these activities for 30 years. That's how old I am these days. And I've always sort of been involved in telling stories about these cultures through the work that I do, whether it's White Lines, whether it's my current agency and so on. I started it to have an outlet really for that, because I've worked as a sort of travel journalist and ski journalist and snowboard journalist for years, and I kind of got a bit bored of pitching and wanted a medium where I could just kind of decide, you know, self-indulgently decide what stories I thought were interesting. As you will be very aware, Ian, that's one of the powers of the podcast medium. So that was kind of the start of it. I've been lucky enough to interview a lot of the, you know, the best known people in those worlds. But really, the kind of editorial filter is, you know, do I find it interesting? Do I think my audience would find it interesting? So I'm not just limited to interviewing like athletes and professional people. Like, you know, I interview musicians, artists, business people, entrepreneurs, people involved in sustainability, anybody who has a connection to these cultures with a viewpoint and an interesting story to tell, I would say, is the editorial approach to Looking Sideways.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say there. There definitely is a lot of similarity there, because in terms of editorial decisions, I'm making those the whole time. And generally, you know, I interview people or invite people on the show if I think their story is interesting, and I kind of have a sense for the audience. Yeah, you do, but yeah, because you know, you get a lot of feedback on it. But when I've done surveys, you know, evidently it's a broad church out there. There are people interested in all sorts of things. But generally, if it's interesting to me, then I think there will be people out there, you know, who will find it interesting to you. And I think you're up to 290 episodes now, so you don't have any trouble still finding new content now.
No, I don't. And I think one of the interesting things for me about doing it is, like, I have always had it as a purely self-indulgent kind of creative outlet. And as you say, I've been lucky enough to find an audience that really go with it. Like, they'll trust what I'm into. So, and that has evolved over the years. And I'm not really that interested in telling, you know, trick porn industry PR'd stories that much. You know, I'm not that bothered about interviewing a 25-year-old kid who's like got a hot video part. You know, there's a lot of that about, and that is absolutely adequately catered for by the ski media and the snowboard media and the action sports media generally. So I'm not interested in that. So what I'm interested in is try to find stories from the margins a bit more. And that's kind of been very, very liberating, because as my interests have evolved, and the Patagonia thing that you mentioned is a really good example of that, and a collaboration that I actually did with Patagonia for 5 years called Type 2, in which I interviewed people that were involved in the intersection of like activism and the outdoors. It's just meant that it's broadened who I can speak to get back to the point of the question. I can, there's room for me to interview someone like Alex Honnold, who hopefully I'm speaking to get on an episode in relation to the announcement, as much as there is to interview like Gavin Fernie Jones, who's come up in this conversation, who runs One Tree at a Time. You know, for me, they're both equally valid stories of outdoor culture. So, yeah, it's a life's work, as I've been known to say.
Excellent. Well, you mentioned Patagonia there. Now, I've listened to a number of your episodes, but it was a series of three episodes you published earlier this year that really caught my attention. And I think it's slightly different. A lot of the, you know, typically your episodes are interviews with individuals, but the subject for these three episodes is the announcement. And it's a deep dive into Patagonia's decision in September 2022 that it was going purpose and not public. And I'm thinking most listeners to the podcast will be familiar with what we're talking about here, but I wondered if you could give us a reminder of what the announcement was in the first place.
Yeah, so that, you're right, September 22, and they announced the company Patagonia that they were making Earth their only shareholder, was the kind of the comms line, you know. And they did well, that sounds a bit disparaging. Like, you know, it is a legitimate extension of their kind of involvement in corporate activism as a company. But what it involved was they said they were going to give their profits to fight climate change. That was roughly the detail that they went into at that point. And that had a huge reaction on social media, because they're a very influential company, obviously. And there's a lot of people who are huge fans of Patagonia's approach to corporate activism, and especially the figure of Yvonne Chouinard and what he symbolizes as a business leader. Quite quickly, you know, and I will say I was one of those proponents. My initial reaction was like, you know, I was invited to take part in the press conference as a journalist, and my immediate reaction was like, yeah, why wouldn't this be a good thing? Quite quickly, as often happens, as we all know, that debate then devolved into a very binary, he's a selfless philanthropic genius on the one hand, to like, he's a tax dodger on the other hand. This must be a tax dodge. This must be, there's got to be an angle. So the reason I decided to make the series was because I thought, well, wouldn't that be interesting to actually find it, like to explore that and try and not find the truth of it, because you're never going to find the truth, to invert the commas, of something like that, but to like find out what it actually means. You know, what are they going to do? Why did they do it? Where did it come from? How is it going to work? Also, what are the scrutiny and the criticisms that they've received? And what will the impact on capitalism? Because they made some very grandiose claims. They were saying this is going to change capitalism. And this is going to have a huge impact on climate change. So like, well, you know, is that true? So that was the initial starting point for me deciding to make those three episodes.
Certainly very interesting. And we're going to have trouble squeezing down a kind of 3-hour series into a conversation just now. But, you know, the podcast is a real deeper dive into what kind of for purpose means in reality. I wondered if you could, they said that given the company to the earth, what you look at within the podcast series is how those profits are now going to be distributed. I wondered if it's feasible to summarize in brief terms what it means in reality with those profits.
Sure. I'll try and be brief. What they did was actually quite a well-worn path. So they have Patagonia. They have the company Patagonia, which is actually many companies, but for argument's sake, let's just call it Patagonia. I should really stress as well, like, I'm no spokesperson for Patagonia. So this isn't me saying the Patagonia party line. This is just what I've gleaned from the work that I've done looking into this. They set up something called the Patagonia Purpose Trust, which is kind of a board that will, when Yvon Chouinard is dead, will oversee the direction of the company, let's put it that way. That then advises the parent company in the middle. And then the third output of that is this thing called the Holdfast Collective, which is a new thing. And what they've essentially done is create a non-profit that the profits get disseminated to. From there, the Holdfast Collective then disperses those funds to various what Patagonia deem to be worthy recipients. And if that sounds vague, I think it's important to point out that one of the main criticisms that they've received is that it is vague because it isn't very clear, for example, like who got to decide who was going to be on the Purpose Trust, who got to decide who was going to be on the Holdfast Collective, and how is it decided where those funds get dispersed and by whom. So that is one of the things I'd like to follow up on, because I think I didn't really cover that in the series, like those critiques, and I think that those are quite interesting questions about that I've been thinking after I've finished the series.
Well, it's certainly a lot to think about within it. I mean, you mentioned that some of those funds get distributed to PATs, which people might be more familiar with in the last 6 months or so, because there's a lot of PACs in the States. Elon Musk created a PAC, which he gave a lot of money to, which then went towards Donald Trump's re-election. And I read in the paper today about how PACs are influencing a Republican re-election in the States. And Bernie Sanders, famously an independent, he actually said, this is a quote from today's paper, billionaires in both parties should not be able to buy elections, including primary elections. And I think this is one of the points that you're sort of looking at there as to where do these funds go? While it might make me happy to know that Patagonia's profits are going into helping liberal causes, that might not suit everyone listening to this podcast. And I think the question is how those decisions are made as to where those funds are used. That's what you're looking at within the podcast.
Yeah, like you touch on two really interesting points there. Like the first point is about billionaire influence. And to be honest, like when I started making this series, it took a long time, that was quite a conceptual point for people to get their head around. Because I think initially everyone was just like, well, what's the problem? He's a good billionaire that's doing something for climate change. But one of the fairly obvious critiques is that, as you've just pointed out, is like, well, that's all well and good if you like what the billionaire does, but if you don't like, because for every Yvon Chouinard, there's a Peter Thiel who's shutting down Gawker, there's the Koch brothers who are setting up far right media groups to discredit climate change, there's an Elon Musk who's set up a PAC that is the argument, really. And I think what's been quite interesting about this podcast, I actually thought the timing of the announcement my series was terrible. Like when I'd finished it, it took 2 years to do, and I was a bit like, I've really sort of missed the boat here, because it's quite long since that happened. But obviously, in some freak of serendipitous timing, since the inauguration, the themes that are covered in the announcement, they seem to get timelier by the week, because obviously one of the hottest, most debated topics in the world right now is the influence of Elon Musk and what he's actually doing to the social fabric in America. So if you needed to understand that argument, which I got a lot of pushback, like when I was writing it, you know, when I speak to friends about that argument, and interestingly, a lot of people in their response to the series have kind of gone, I don't really care, I like what he does, therefore I'm behind it. But obviously this is a democratic principle that's at stake, as we now know. That's one of the I'm not going to say like I had a crystal ball and thought like, oh well, you know, this is going to have a interesting commentary on what's going on now, because who in the world predicted that? But I did always think that the Patagonia decision was a supremely interesting way into many, many pertinent themes that we grapple with right now: climate change, democracy, the influence of governments, the influence of billionaire, the state of philanthropy, the tension between public and private investment when we try and impact something like climate change. So that's what I tried to explore through the series.
Wow, it's a very interesting listen. I mean, you know, I rarely tackle politics on the podcast, tend to steer clear of that. But I think that the discussion that you're talking about here is all about politics and about, you know, philosophical thoughts as well. I've never heard the phrase extractive capitalism so often in a podcast. But I wonder if I could ask you a couple of like sort of podcasting questions. Did it take you 2 years to prepare? Because it's extremely professional. I really enjoyed listening to it. The sound editing is excellent. It must have taken a long time to put together.
Yeah, I mean, I was doing it alongside everything else that I do. Like, so I was doing it alongside my day job and also running Looking Sideways and try to convert a house in Normandy. So that practically, it was done in my spare time. The other thing is as well, like, I didn't know where it was going to end up. Quite, you know, that might sound obvious, but it was a very fulfilling creative project, because I didn't know it was going to be about all the things it ended up being about. You know, like I was aware of some of the top line scrutiny, for example, It's a Tax Dodge, which was the one that got the most coverage at the time. But it was only when I went into it that I realized, actually, this is a critique of corporate philanthropy. This is about democracy. This is about what the future of capitalism looks like. And it evolved in that way. So I'm quite glad it took that amount of time, because I learned a lot, and that's what made it what it ended up being, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as we discussed before, something of real interest to you that you've been able to pursue. And I think you've created some really interesting ideas there. I'm so impressed with the series, and I highly recommend listeners who want the full story, listen to Matt's podcast. I'll put links into the show notes as well. And I've listened to, you know, all three, actually, more than once. And while I do think of the announcement in a completely different way, I personally still think it's a tremendous move by Patagonia that will benefit and help the planet. And that is crucial, because on the podcast, I'm often referring, I've already mentioned it in this episode, the existential threat that global warming presents the snow sports industry. I'm just going to segue now to my trip to Chamonix earlier this winter. I went to Chamonix in January. One of the reasons I wanted to go there was to take a look at the new Montanvert gondola that makes the Mer de Glace more accessible for visitors. I've written an article about that for We Love to Ski, and I'll put a link in the show notes about it. But, you know, I first skied the Vallée Blanche in 1982 and then whiskied all the way back to Chamonix. It's very, very different now. It's still France's largest glacier, but it's the glacier's retreated and steps have been added to allow you to get back up to Montanvert to ski back if it were feasible. By 2019, there were 580 steps to get back to Chamonix. So what Chamonix have done, they opened a new gondola, February 2023, cost €23 million to create as well. It makes access easier. There's still steps to deal with, but it now covers the distance in minutes. Now, the question is that just pushing a problem down the line? You know, the location of the gondola is further up the glacier itself to make it to basically cover themselves for decades or so in the future. I spoke to a mountain guide, Brad Carlson, from the area to find out his thoughts on the pros and cons of the new lift.
I'm here today with Brad Carlson. I'm in Chamonix. He's in Servoz, which is only down the road, but for various reasons we couldn't be face to face. But thank you so much for finding the time, Brad. How are you today?
Doing well, thanks, Ian. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, and now you're a mountain guide in Chamonix. I know you're obviously from the States originally, but you're working out here now. And one of the reasons I wanted to speak to you is to try and get some insight into what it's like for someone who's working with the glaciers on a day-to-day basis. And specifically, I'm thinking of the Mer de Glace because we're looking at that new lift that they've got there. Let's look at ice climbing first. It's affected you and guides and the ability to do ice climbing on the Mer de Glace?
Absolutely. Yeah, so I passed my entrance exams to become a mountain guide in 2016. And so we were climbing on these seracs and sort of ice canyon walls that are long since gone. And so even on at a pretty short time scale, the change has just been tremendous. And over the course of a single season, for example, in 2022, which was an extremely hot summer in the Alps and throughout Europe, the Mer de Glace lost 17 meters of thickness just under our feet between the late spring and the autumn. So it's not even from year to year. It's really from week to week, month to month, we're adapting to a constantly changing environment.
But when we were chatting in the green room before, you said it's almost like your office is melting.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, we're out there, you know, doing ice climbing, finishing the Vallée Blanche as a ski descent. In a way, you know, this high mountain environment is our office. And, you know, it's almost like it's melting out from underneath us. It's just the change is extremely rapid. And we could talk about impact because, of course, as guides and as being part of the tourism industry, we have an impact. But certainly from, you know, in terms of emissions, but from an adaptation standpoint, no matter what, we're absolutely confronted by this rapid change.
When you're guiding people on the Vallée Blanche at the moment, I think we'll discuss how the lift impact on it. But without that lift, it's quite a physical exercise to get from the bottom of the Vallée Blanche, from the Mer de Glace up to Montanvert to descend Chamonix.
Yeah, certainly, you know, from the days that you were describing in the 80s, early 90s, when you could ski all the way out to the Moté snack bar. You know, the change has just been tremendous. And skiing the Vallée Blanche these past years, you know, often the snow cover is quite low at the very end, can be a bit rocky. And then there's this strenuous walk up a metal staircase up to the gondola that was built in the late 80s, where the glacier arrived at the time. Or sorry, the gondola went down to the level of the glacier at the time. And so that combination of some tricky skiing, maybe some walking at the end, plus, you know, a half hour, 40 minutes of walking up a staircase with your heavy ski equipment in the full sun after a long day in the mountains. Yeah, it's definitely strenuous. And the new gondola, you know, we could say, is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is it productive adaptation or just kicking the can down the road? But what's for sure is that it makes the Vallée Blanche in its current state much more accessible, much less physically strenuous. And certainly as guides, it makes our job a lot easier to get to the end of the Vallée Blanche. And then we can, you know, walk up just a few flights of stairs instead of, you know, hundreds of stairs, steps, and be whisked up to the Montanvert train. So it definitely makes the Vallée Blanche more accessible.
I mean, I guess that is a point you mentioned there. Is it just kicking the problem further down the road? But there's also this balance, and I don't know where I stand on the answer to this, but whether or not by making it easier, you're opening up the Vallée Blanche to many more skiers, and that in itself probably doesn't help. Maybe it should be just something that's restricted to the people who have the ability to do it?
Yeah, it's a fair question. The new gondola certainly maintains the value, access to the Vallée Blanche is, you know, essentially something accessible to tourism and to mass tourism. Whereas if the gondola didn't exist, we're moving more and more towards something that's reserved towards, let's say, a backcountry skiing elite, something that's a bit more strenuous, a bit more technical and difficult. And once again, I, you know, Brad Carlson, don't have the answer or the ultimate opinion on that. I think that, you know, as mountain guides, we're, once again, it's making our job easier and it's maintaining access, hopefully even for the years to come, to the Mer de Glace Basin, which is absolutely key for us, both for the Vallée Blanche descent during the winter and also in the summer for accessing the five high mountain huts that are key base camps for alpinism around the Mer de Glace.
I think you said it's not for you to decide. It's not for me to decide either. But to me, it sounds like it would be ideal if it wasn't required. But if it improves access overall for both summer and for winter and enables more people to be able to benefit from seeing something spectacular like the Mer de Glace, which, you know, sadly, maybe by the end of this century, you know, it's not going to be there. But in that interim, while it is, I think the more people who can appreciate it, the better. So that's brilliant, Brad. Thank you for sharing those thoughts with us. And we'll have to have you back on the show at another time down the track.
All right. Thanks, Ian. Appreciate it.
I actually think this is the most interesting topic in climate change right now. And I'm actually planning to write a follow-up series to the announcement, which is called The Lift, because I think ski resorts are, and you've just alluded to this, they're obviously like the canary in the coal mine when it comes to climate change. And they're also like, and this is the work that you do, Sarah, so you know this more than I do, you live there. But obviously they're also supercharged capitalist environments. You know, they're the ultimate transactional relationship with nature. And they're also where people are starting to have to make real choices about how they react to the impact of climate change. So I just think, so, you know, they're going to build a lift in Beauzelle, aren't they, to Courchevel, which I wrote a piece on, which is hugely contentious to some people, but a brilliant thing to other people. Similarly, you know, Cottonwood Canyon in Utah, there's a thing, this lift that you talk about. This is the biggest story in the ski industry for me at the minute.
I think the points you're making are valid. I could give you another example as well, which is the new Jondry 3S lift in Les Des Alpes. I spoke to the guys from the lift company while I was there, and they were saying, oh, this is something that will, you know, guarantee us skiing for 30 years. And I said, well, only 30 years? He said, well, that's the lifespan that we're looking at realistically. What they're doing is they're bringing these lifts in because it's going to provide year-round tourism. People will come. You know, it's accessible. You can go up there as a pedestrian, as a mountain biker, as a skier, etc. It's a feature of the resort in the same way that places like Chamonix with the Aiguille de Midi and Montanvert, or Zermatt with Cornergrat and Klein Matterhorn, get scores of visitors who want to go up high onto the mountain all year round. Resorts are thinking about these things and having these showpiece lifts. And I think that would be a really interesting series.
Yeah, just to say, I think actually I completely agree with Matt that this is one of the biggest issues that's facing us. And we've got a few of these lift discussions that are happening in various resorts, but pretty much every single resort is facing this on another level. Do they put in another reservoir for snow cannons? How many more snow cannons do they put in? Where do they do that? And in every resort, there's these new structures that are going in. There's opposition to that. There's the for, the against. And then with a lot of it, there's the argument as well, the economic argument that all these resorts very much rely on skiing as an industry, as jobs, and that going forward, while the summer is growing, it's not there yet. So it's a really hard one to look. And the Montanvert as well, one of the arguments is getting people to see the glacier, to see what's happening, is a powerful way of getting people to act on it.
Sure. Actually, on that point, Sarah, one of the things I would recommend to anyone who goes up there is they check out the Glassorium. That is a small museum devoted to glaciology. It's due to be replaced by a bigger centre later this year. But the point is to educate visitors about the life of the glacier. I found it really interesting, and it is shocking even to me. It's lost 3 kilometres in length since 1820. 40% of the glacial volume has disappeared in 2 years. And it makes it very obvious. Now, I think this argument is, it, are they just monetizing it, commercializing it, etc.? But, you know, I'm a glass half full kind of person. I think the more people who go up there, the more people who can see this and pass on the message that what we need to do is we need to take action, like, for example, taking the train to go to Morzine, etc., you know, reducing our emissions, will help to benefit us in the long run. We need to share those thoughts with others. Right, we're going to come to close the show just now. I enjoy all feedback. Always interested to hear what you think. Please do contact me on social at Ski Podcast or by email, theskipodcast@gmail.com. A few bits of feedback since the last episode. Julian Holland said episode 237 was great. Keeping my fingers crossed for a few more dumps in the Austronauts before my 2 weeks in Lech. Skiing Postie on Spotify said, Dry Zinnen, that was episode 237, sounds great. I'll definitely be looking at a train ski trip soon. Reed Alton said, another great episode. There are now 252 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with. I had a look, 137 of those were listened to in the last week. So if you enjoyed this episode, why not go to skipodcast.com, take a look around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find something of interest to you. In the last week, just over half of our listeners were in the UK. The next most were in the States, and everyone else spread as far and wide as Indonesia, Latvia, and Nigeria. So if you like the podcast, there are three things you can do to help. You can follow us, you can give us a review or leave a comment on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and you can book your ski hire with InterSport Rent using the code SKIPODCAST or take the link in the show notes. You can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at the Ski Podcast. You can also follow us on WhatsApp for exclusive material released ahead of every podcast. Just look in the show notes for that link. I'd like to thank my guest today. Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ian. It's been a pleasure.
And Matt, thank you.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for the good vibes about the show. Much appreciated.
Excellent. And finally, listener, thanks for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.